Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. It's the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. America's communities on a collision course. That's our focus this hour. Look in your own community. Look in your own heart. See what the forces that we've seen all week long in Ferguson, Missouri, are capable of. And are they possible in your own community, your own neighborhood? We'd love to hear from you. The hot summer violence in St. Louis tells a local story, but also a national one. We're all in this conversation. Are divided citizens at the boiling point? Well, we may be seeing a turning point in Ferguson at the end of this week. After nearly a week of rioting, a voice of reason, mediation, and solidarity from Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. Here he is in an interview with CNN.
Well, I think because this is my community, I don't, you know, the thing that I am first is a man. The black man and who I am is down the chain, but I'm a man first. And so I take the approach from a man's standpoint. And a young man lost his life. And so I grieve for that family because I have a son.
Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri State Highway Patrol, speaking of the death of Michael Brown that began all of the unrest in Ferguson. Captain Johnson told the people of Ferguson his hope and expectation for the next few days.
We are going to have a different approach and have the approach that we're in this together.
Part of that new approach is today's release of the name of the officer who shot Michael Brown. The Ferguson Police Department identified him as Officer Darren Wilson, a six-year veteran of the department. But it's the leadership of Captain Ron Johnson that's really made a difference. He spent much of last night with protesters, listening to their stories and marching alongside them through the streets. Captain Johnson ordered police to remove their tear gas masks, a decision that ushered in a peaceful and celebratory night in Ferguson, something our next guest can personally attest to. Don Marsh is host of St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Don, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John. Nice to be with you.
So it's great to talk to you. Your reflections on this week, and was there a turning point last night, do you think?
I think the turning point came around the middle of the day yesterday when Ron Johnson was announced as the guy in charge here. It was a breath of fresh air, palpable. You could see the difference and feel the difference. And I was out there last night, and what a tremendous difference there was in the crowd. You used the word celebratory. We've used the word almost like a party atmosphere. There were thousands of people out there, cars with horns blaring, people carrying signs, the same protests, the same concerns. But nonetheless, there was just a different mood. I mean, people were literally happy about what had happened, I would say.
What would you say sparked all of the tension? Is this the result of tension that existed between the Ferguson cops and the community? Was it their approach, their tactics in the early going? Unfolded for us.
Well, I think there are a couple of things. Yeah, there's been a long simmering problem in places like Ferguson where you have a white administration, a white police department, and the majority of the population is black. There are any number of incidents that have been recorded of racial profiling and that sort of thing. But, you know, I have to look back to two nights ago when the county police came in with their riot gear and their assault weapons, sniper rifles, armored cars. And that gave it such a different tone. They were arbitrarily and indiscriminately, it appeared to me, firing tear gas canisters, sometimes in neighborhoods where there were no protesters. These things were landing on front lawns. It outraged the population and outraged the community at large, not only within Ferguson, but outside. I watched that on television. I stood up. I could not believe what I was seeing in a community just a few miles away from where I was.
You know, Don, this, I think, is probably the big takeaway from this week. I mean, we're seeing certainly local issues, and you've described them there in Ferguson. But we're also seeing the consequences of U.S. Homeland Security handing out this paramilitary gear since 9/11, kind of like Easter jelly beans. I mean, you can go through the numbers, millions and millions of dollars worth of armored vehicles, machine gun nests, night vision goggles, tear gas canisters. All this sort of, taser crowd control stuff has been handed out over the last decade. And, you really got the sense in Ferguson that people were itching to use it. We talked with this fellow, Jack Hoban, this morning, president of Resolution Group International, a professional training organization that works with military and law enforcement organizations. Listen to this chilling sort of discussion of the consequences of some of this technology.
You know, one of the issues with technology is that sometimes technology drives the tactics. You know, they say the old saw is, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The same thing with this technology. You know, the tactical technology starts to drive the tactics. And I think it's very important that the police chief realize that we need to switch this paradigm around, where the ethic of "we are here to protect you" drives the tactic, and that drives the use of the technology, not the other way around.
If everything you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If all you have is a machine gun, everybody looks like a terrorist. Is that what you saw in Ferguson?
Yeah, that's very much what I saw. But I think this is likely to change, too. Senator McCaskill was out here yesterday, and she was raising concerns about this equipment being distributed the way that it is. And you're right. I mean, a lot of people here have just equated it with toys for the cops. And that's probably unfair to say in many regards, but that's the impression that people have. I was struck by one of the comments made by the police chief in St. Louis County a couple of days ago. You know, St. Louis has been fairly benign when it comes to confrontations between police and large groups of people. There have only been one or two significant demonstrations. They were 40 years ago. But the chief said, "We have all this equipment. Nothing really like this has ever happened here before. We do not drill for this." You know, here they have this stuff, and they don't go out in the fields and learn how to use it and use it properly, not only to drive the darn things or to shoot the things, but, you know, how to use it to control crowds in a way that isn't as threatening as was the case the other night.
It's really telling that they would candidly admit that it's just stuff that they have in the garage and they don't necessarily have a tactical training program.
I was quite surprised when he admitted that. But, you know, that tells a large part of the story. You've seen the pictures. Everybody, the whole world has seen the pictures of what was going on the other night. And everyone, even people who have never been to war, say it looked like Baghdad, you know. Well, I guess we've seen the pictures from Baghdad, too, in past days, and sure looked like that to me.
So, Don, you have a long historical memory here. You referred to riots 40 years ago, and you covered those.
Well, I covered riots in Baltimore 40 years ago, and that was one of the granddaddy of all riots.
Yeah.
From Detroit and Newark and places like that were going. Yeah, a number of people were killed there, hundreds of thousands of arrests and what have you. But St. Louis historically has not had that. I'm referring actually to a demonstration back in the 60s led by former Congressman Bill Clay. His son now holds that same seat, Lacey Clay. But that was a demonstration at a local bank, and the black population was incensed because they put their money in this neighborhood bank, but there were no black people working at the bank. So they demonstrated with placards. It was peaceful. There were some arrests and a little time spent in the city jail. And ultimately, they prevailed. And it changed everything, not only at the bank, but any number of commercial operations here in town, where they suddenly became aware that they needed to have more black representation in their sales staffs or office staffs or whatever. It was a successful demonstration, but, you know, nothing like Ferguson. Nobody was hurt that I can recall. And, you know, it was a totally different kind of situation.
So, Don, here's somebody who's probably one of your listeners commenting on the sense of racial disparity, racial division in the St. Louis area. Let me play you a clip from Mariah Richardson, who's an actress, playwright of St. Louis Public Radio, the Black and White Oral History Project, and you worked on this project. Listen to this sentiment, and I wonder if you could comment on it, please.
White people really believe that black people are different from them. And that's just so odd to me. It's like, I want the same things that you want. I want to have health insurance. I want to have a nice home. We're not that different. All that stuff that seems to be different is very superficial.
You know, we expect the political system to defuse the tensions between people, but it doesn't necessarily have that effect. And I think in recent years, it's had the opposite effect. It's raised the tensions. And so something like this happens and poof.
St. Louis has a reputation, and I think deservedly so, of being one of the most racially polarized communities in the country. There's always been a deep division, at least in terms of the physical separation between whites and blacks. That has changed somewhat in recent years, but it all goes back to a time when the restrictive covenants were in place here and elsewhere. And the black population lived in a very small area and could not buy homes anyplace else. But as a result of a St. Louis case, back as Shelley versus Kramer back in the late 40s, the Supreme Court ruled that restrictive covenants were unconstitutional and discriminatory. They were lifted, and the black population began to move out, and they moved north toward places like Ferguson and Delwood and other communities in that area. And when they did that, the white population freaked out and began to sell their homes, and this began white flight in the St. Louis area, and emptied the communities like this primarily of a white population. Ferguson now is 70% black, 30% white. It was much the opposite not too many years ago. So the whites fled, and when they fled, they were afraid that their houses were going to be diminished in value. But what they were really saying was, we are afraid. They were saying, we're afraid that black men are going to come in here and rape our women. And that kind of fear, I think, has bled over for a generation or two since that time, and perhaps before. You know, that's the genesis of this. I would dispute what Mariah had said with regard to what whites think. I think some whites think the way that she was describing it, but not all whites. There is a significant population here, a white population, that wants to reach out and wants to get along. A significant portion of the black population feels the same way. There are some on both sides, however, very clearly, who feel just the opposite.
Well, Don Marsh, the legacy of what you describe is evident if you just hop in your car right next to the Gateway Arch and drive west and north out of St. Louis. You see the consequences of that population shift. Don Marsh, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Don Marsh is the host of St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Here are some of your thoughts on all of this.
We're really a police state. And we're deluded about what freedom means. For most ethnic, racial minorities in this country, every day is a reminder that they are considered a threat and need to be controlled. As a white man, I don't have to face this. But no one is free unless we're all free.
That was Brad from Portland, Oregon. And there was sympathy for the people of Ferguson, Missouri, in demonstrations in Baltimore, Los Angeles, San Diego, Atlanta, Seattle, Miami, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. last night. Here are protesters in New York City holding a vigil for Michael Brown. We also heard from a listener in Winter Park, Florida, who feels threatened by how fast things can get violent. Modern America, this listener says, is filled with people with no self-control, an inability to wait for answers before reaching a conclusion, no respect for the property of others who have no involvement in the original incident other than physical location. I understand being outraged, but I do not understand the violence. Here's another voice from Portland, Oregon.
Police are afraid of being seen as what they are. They believe they act with impunity and no longer need to follow the Constitution. Maybe they need to teach civics in community college. I know my rights. The police should as well.
Thanks for that, Ariel. Later on the Takeaway, lessons, national lessons from Ferguson, Missouri. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of this national conversation. Here's a quiet, inescapable question from someone whose private world we are a part of now. Crystal Miller, July 11th, 2014.
Am I always going to feel like everything that happens has something to do with cancer? I'm wondering if that's going to be my first thought every time something shows up on my body.
Crystal Miller is one of the women we've met as part of our series on breast cancer, Under Her Skin. Her audio diary takes us right into those moments when it's just her and her body.
Tonight, I was waiting in the car for a friend, and I was just like feeling on my neck, and I felt a lump. And I don't know if it's a lymph node or if it's just a bump. I'm definitely going to try to email my doctor and tell the radiation oncologist or nurse on Monday. I am hoping that this is nothing, and, you know, it's just something normal.
Normal is an unusual word these days for Crystal. She's had surgery and chemotherapy and is now undergoing radiation. You might say anxiety is normal for her now, but she can't let that get in the way.
There's nothing in fear that serves me.
Here's Anita Coleman, July 4th, 2014.
They know that I'm just sick. That's how they see it.
Family time has changed now that Anita is undergoing treatment. She has to balance her joy at seeing her three young grandchildren, aged 2.5, 4, and 7, with the need to preserve her energy.
Basically, on my down days, they don't come around me because, number one, my patience level is short and the little bickering back and forth, I can't take it. But I really don't want them to see me barely moving some days, because children, they have lasting impressions. And the impression that I don't want them to see is when I can't barely walk, the days that it's hard to walk, or the days where I just am tired.
July 17th, 2014, our third Brave Pioneer, Lisa Eccles, took the step to bring her 16-year-old son into her treatment experience.
He got a chance to see what I really go through when I go for my treatment.
And right there with the oncology doctor taking blood and monitoring vitals and the Herceptin chemotherapy drip running, the two of them also found a mother-son moment.
We was able to sit down and really talk, and for me to find out what was going on in his life and for him to see the lifestyle that I'm going through now.
Lisa is moving forward. Here's journal entry August 8th, 2014.
I am going to return to work very soon. I can't wait to walk the halls of the hospital and speak to all my coworkers and just laugh and talk and enjoy life itself.
Lisa says she can't wait to get back to her babies in the neonatal intensive care unit. On some level, you can sense they miss her too. If you like following along with Lisa, Crystal, and Anita and want to be a part of the conversation, join our Facebook group. Go to Facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin. Our next conversation will be focusing on financial issues when cancer strikes. We want to hear about the money issues you've encountered. What surprised you most about the medical costs? How did you budget for them? And did you get any help along the way? How much did money weigh on you during and after treatment? We're sure Crystal, Anita, and Lisa will have a lot to say about that, and you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And again, join our Facebook group for this project. To find all their full stories and everything we're working on in this series, visit us at thetakeaway.org/series/breast cancer. You'll find interviews and more from the audio diaries anytime.
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Friday, movie time with the Movie Date podcast team. They host the Movie Date podcast, but Rafer Guzman is also film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, also culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Hey, John.
Hi, John.
Well, let's start with Let's Be Cops. Here's a clip.
I'm sorry. I had no idea that you were a cop.
Oh. Oh, no, I'm not really a cop.
What do you mean?
We're more than cops. Do not let that humble face fool you. And we all have to force talk about, we think he needs a serious back massage.
Okay.
Not Oscar material, but definitely no. A comedy.
Well, I wouldn't even say that. Damon Wayans and Jake Johnson are obviously playing two 30-something going-nowhere guys who decide to start impersonating cops for fun. However, the jokes really fall flat. It doesn't have a lot of punch. And when you have other mismatched buddy movies, movies like this just aren't funny enough.
Sounds like they needed more jokes rather than editing some of them out, Rafer.
I think that's true. The movie doesn't have quite the energy that I wanted it to, but I actually found it kind of cute and sweet. And I think Damon Wayans and I think Jake Johnson have, they're both really likable personalities. And I actually walked out of the film in kind of a good mood. I thought it was kind of enjoyable.
Slightly more high-minded offering, Frank. Let's hear a clip. Here's the main character who always wears a giant bobblehead-looking mask.
Would it help if I said my facial expressions out loud?
Maybe.
Welcoming smile.
Frank, you've been up all night talking to the keyboard player?
I'm not just a keyboard player. I write songs, too.
You write your own songs?
Mm-hmm. I'd love to play some for you sometime.
I really like that. Big, non-threatening grin.
Delighted look.
What's the premise here?
Well, it's actually based very loosely on a true story. A guy named Chris Seavey, who created a character named Frank Sidebottom. This movie takes that character and makes him more of a mentally ill, kind of outsider artist, genius musician type. And that's Michael Fassbender, who plays the entire film pretty much inside a giant papier-mâché head. It's really a story about a guy, the keyboard player there, Donald Gleason, trying to get into Frank's head and find out what makes this genius tick.
A daring movie. Does it get into your heart?
Actually, it did by the end of it. I actually thought that the music scenes were pretty great. The music itself is very good. And Michael Fassbender magically, just because he's so talented, even though he's in this giant papier-mâché head the whole time, he really brings humanity to this role.
Oh, you both like it. It's in limited release, but people will be able to find it. And now let's just lower the bar a bit. Unmistakable sound there of Expendables 2, a franchise. Expendables 3, actually. What did you think of this, Rafer?
Well, bar lowered. I think happening with this is you've got Sylvester Stallone, who's been spearheading this franchise, is maybe trying to ease some of the old action stars like Jason Statham and Terry Crews, Dolph Lundgren. Maybe try to ease them out a little bit and bring in some new meat. You've got Kellan Lutz from Twilight, Ronda Rousey. She's a mixed martial arts fighter. So you might see a little bit of passing the torch here. The guy who's really great in this film is Mel Gibson. He plays the villain, an arms dealer named Conrad Stonebanks. And while everyone else is kind of shooting off rounds and grunting, he just digs into the role, and he's a lot of fun. And he kind of gives the movie a little bit of a boost.
And The Giver is a big movie this week, Kristen.
Absolutely. It's highly anticipated, but also there's a little dread there. It's based on the 1993 novel by Lois Lowry, and it's another post-apocalyptic young adult future.
I know that there's something more,
Fiona.
Something missing from our lives. No, not missing. Something that has been stolen from me and from you. I don't know what it is exactly, but Jonas does.
My kids love this book.
Oh, it's great. And, you know, there's some concern because this actually predates Divergent, predates The Hunger Games. But I think because the movie's coming out after those, some people are going to think that this is really derivative. But it's very smartly done. The acting by Meryl Streep and by Jeff Bridges in particular are fantastic. And I was really moved by this.
And on the podcast this week?
This week we have a listener who would like some modern retellings of ancient stories, things that are better than Hercules, which is currently in theaters. And we came up with a pretty funny list for him, so hopefully he'll find some hope in that list.
A public service, right?
That's right. We try. This is the important work that we're doing, John.
Every week they try. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, also a culture producer for The Takeaway. Movie Date podcast folks, have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too, John.
Sitting still, driving, walking down a busy street, or even working at multiple screens online, the world seems to come at us like an oncoming train. Each day we stand on the tracks of the information overload unlimited, and each day the front of our brains, our senses, and short-term memory are left in the dust. Meanwhile, deep in our brains, you might say it's more like a lazy day on the beach. Meandering, daydreaming, blocking out all the train noise, just laying around. One part of our brain gets run over, while the other floats in the clouds. Daniel Levitin is Dean of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva School at KGI on the Claremont campus in California. He says these two ways of paying attention are in conflict unless we slow down and get off the train tracks. Our brains simply aren't capable of dealing with the overload, and without downtime, the deep brain's creativity doesn't get a chance to work. He's the author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. Daniel Levitin, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Nice to be back, John.
So I think it's kind of easy for you to say, overload, we got to settle down, we got to take vacations. You're talking to me from Santa Barbara.
That's right. Yeah, it's gorgeous. You know, the thing is, though, I think even in our daily life, we are in this over-caffeinated time where we're asked to do so much more at work and at home. We feel as though if we stop for even 15 minutes, we're going to fall behind. And there's a research about this now. Neuroscientists have been studying this for 20 years, and a lot of the information they've discovered hasn't trickled down to the average person. And one of the big things is working like that with the pedal to the metal all the time is counterproductive. And there are a number of studies that show that if you keep trying to solve a problem or keep trying to push forward, you're not able to activate your creative problem-solving mode, which is a different mode of thought that kicks in when you're relaxing, either in Santa Barbara or in the annals of your own mind.
So stimulus, you know, information coming at you in a giant stream, you know, your printer may be able to deal with it because it's got a great cache. It can store, you know, hundreds of documents in the front end of the printer. But our brains don't work that way. We don't store things in the front end when information is bombarding us. We actually kind of shut down.
That's exactly right, John. We store things in the back end. Our long-term memory is exquisitely capacious, but our short-term immediate memory, what you can hold on to in the moment, is limited to about three or four things.
Wow. Every day, people take in the equivalent of 174 newspapers worth of information, which is five times greater than what we were probably doing back in 1986. 21,274 television stations produce 85,000 hours of original programming every day, and we watch an average of 5 hours of television per day. I mean, that's a huge increase as well.
Yes, and it's no wonder all of us are feeling like we can't keep up. Take YouTube, for example, just to throw another statistic in the mix. There are 6,000 hours of new video uploaded to YouTube every hour. So if you're watching an hour of YouTube video, you're already 5,999 hours behind.
So when my kids say, "I just want to chill, Dad, and watch TV and look at YouTubes," they're actually not chilling out. They're not relaxing themselves at all.
You know, YouTube, computers, browsing, and television watching, those are great leisure activities, but they're not the same as engaging what we call the default mode of the brain, the creative, free flow, free association part of our consciousness. That is an attentional mode that's well identified, and it trades off with being actively engaged in a task. And, you know, there are several ways to get in that mode. One's to just stare out the window and let your mind wander. For those who have difficulty getting into that mode, a walk in nature can do it, or listening to the kind of music that you find to be mind opening.
How do you organize and structure your downtime to create this sort of vacation effect, even in the middle of a day?
Well, one thing that's very effective is naps. Even a 10 or 15 minute power nap can be very restorative, effectively hit the neural reset button in the brain. And according to some studies, it provides a working IQ increase of about 10 points. The other thing you can do is just take a break, take a little walk around and not think about work for 10 or 15 minutes. You know, we can all take a lesson from air traffic controllers. They have all kinds of things coming at them from different directions. There's lots of moving parts. And I think many of us feel that way in our daily work. Of course, there's less at stake for most of us than for an air traffic controller. But it's no accident that air traffic controllers are regulated. And after 45 to 60 minutes of on time, they're required to take a 15 to 30 minute break.
Now, if you're taking a nap, is it okay for me to say to my boss, I'm increasing my IQ on the job as opposed to, you know, being lazy?
I would think so. I mean, the research certainly bears that out. Or if you're just staring out the window, or you're looking at a painting or a photograph that you find aesthetically pleasing, you're reading a book perhaps, anything that allows your mind to enter this kind of daydreamy mode. Have you ever been reading a passage and you find that your eyes have gotten ahead of you and all these words went by but you weren't paying attention?
It happens constantly to me.
That's the daydreaming mode. That's the restorative state that you want to get into after you've been working for an hour or so.
Why does it seem that the back part of the brain can veto the front of the brain, in the sense that someone who really can't, you know, who's constantly got a to-do list going in their brain, no matter what it is that they're doing, even if they're just sitting reading the paper?
There's research on this too, and what it tells us is that if you can write that chatter, that stream of conversations or admonishments or whatever's going on in your head, if you can write them all down on a piece of paper, then your brain will stop trying to remind you that you need to get them done. And then look at them and figure out what it is you need to do to push them forward. So suppose one of the things in your head is, is it time to put Aunt Rose in a rest home? and this has been bothering you for days. Well, once you have it on paper, you can start analyzing it. Why is it I haven't made this decision yet? Well, maybe I need more information. What information will help me to push this decision forward? Do I want to visit the rest home? Do I want to talk to other family members about it? Do I want to talk to Aunt Rose? Do I want to have a cognitive assessment? Those are things you can actually do. The question, is it time to put Aunt Rose in the rest home? That's not really doable. And so it rattles around in your head until you figure out how to move it forward.
So if I just write down, what is the meaning of life? It's going to come to me.
It may.
Daniel Levitin, Dean of Arts and Humanities at the Minerva Schools at KGI and author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. He spoke with us from Santa Barbara. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Help us out here, won't you? Where's your mental beach where you have the space to think and relax? Take us to your beach, wherever it is, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us at The Takeaway, real or virtual, but let's all try to get some tangible benefits from even a little downtime. Take me to the tide line of your dreamiest beach. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.